YouTubers have flagged YouTube's search algorithm for being biased against transgender videos and producers. But if YouTube suppresses this content, it can deprive young people of critical knowledge.
I want to begin a future with a person I love to marry. I want to be happy with my child and my family. I also want protection and the support I don't have in my country. This is why I came, for a happy future.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A storied Singapore leader's grandson, Dots the Pink, YouTube Math sells trans content short, and U.S. border chaos engulfs a Salvadoran lesbian mother and child. Those stories and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending July 28, 2018. Singapore's 10th annual Pink Dot Festival, celebrating the diversity of love in the Southeast Asian city-state on July 21st, was said to have broken all attendance records and was preceded a few days earlier by the proud self-outing of the grandson of Singapore's revered founder. Thousands converged on Speaker's Corner in Hong Lim Park, the only area in Singapore where pre-approved public demonstrations are allowed. Most celebrants were adorned in pink and carried pink-hued flashlights. As night fell, thousands formed a large glowing heart that melted human hearts in photographs taken from high above the park. We couldn't find a published crowd estimate this year, but some 20,000 people bathed the night skies in pink in 2017. The government has done its best to suppress the event. It banned foreigners from sponsoring or participating in the Pink Dot Festival in 2016. Several multinational conglomerates with offices in Singapore had provided major financial support until then. But organizers persevered, recruiting a total of 113 local business sponsors this year, all in compliance with a government edict.
The theme of Pink Dot 10 was We Are Ready, accompanied by demands for equal rights for LGBTQ people in the nation's schools, workplaces, and healthcare system. Singaporean actors Adrian Pang and Lim Yu Beng called for the repeal of Section 377A of the Singapore Criminal Code, the remnant of British colonial rule that, like India's Penal Code Section 377, makes private consensual adult same-gender sex a crime. Theater director Ivan Heng, who married his husband in London in 2014, echoed this year's Pink Dot theme by saying that we are ready to see more positive portrayals of LGBTQ people in our mainstream media without censorship, because we are sick and tired of being seen as tragic characters or vilified as perverts. Premier Lee Hsien Loong has said that he's prepared to keep Section 377A on the books until social attitudes change. His nephew, 31-year-old Lee Hwan Woo, who's also the grandson of Singapore's first prime minister, Lee Kuan Yew, is doing his best to speed up that process. He came out with his 27-year-old partner by his side, veterinarian Hirui Heng, a few days before the Pink Dot Festival, where the couple was widely photographed. Hwan Woo urged straight allies to attend in a Facebook posting and wrote that all LGBTQ people have a moral responsibility to come. If you do not stand up yourself, he wrote, you cannot expect others to fight for you.
Barbados Islanders celebrated LGBTQ Pride for the first time on July 22nd in the capital city of Bridgetown by dancing down the street to sound trucks blaring songs like Diana Ross's I'm Coming Out. A colorful carnival atmosphere prevailed as an estimated 150 local activists, their supporters, and even a few tourists paraded through downtown. Organizers faced less than smooth sailing to pull off the march, however. They only secured permission to hold the event 2 days before it kicked off and faced vocal opposition from fundamentalist religious leaders. Several told a press conference the week before that the queer agenda is a form of neocolonialism that opposes the biblical narrative of Adam and Eve. One of the organizers, Rowan Mohammed, told Pink News that she genuinely feared that the venomous rhetoric would spark homophobic violence at the parade, but was pleasantly surprised by the amount of love and positivity that overwhelmed the air. Mohammed said she was especially encouraged by local Anglican minister Clifford Hall, who exhorted the parade rally to not let anyone bully you or torment or terrorize you. They have had their day. Yours is now and tomorrow and forever. So speaking as a priest, I say welcome all to the flock of Christ.
Gay and lesbian couples in Cuba are achingly close to getting the right to marry. The island's National Assembly unanimously approved several changes to the country's constitution on July 23rd that include extending civil marriage rights to same-gender couples. The draft revisions will be open for public consultation and debate from August 13th through November 15th. A referendum in the communist nation will follow. While the revisions also include recognizing private property for the first time in decades, local commentators are calling marriage equality among the most significant. Former Cuban President Raúl Castro's daughter, Mariela Castro Espín, has been the most vocal public advocate for LGBTQ equality on the island and heads the well-respected National Center for Sex Education. She led a conga against homophobia and transphobia in March, where thousands danced down Havana streets among rainbow flags and Fidel Castro banners and led a rally for marriage equality in May. Continuing reverence for Fidel forgives his sending an estimated 25,000 gay men to labor camps in the earlier years of his presidency. He formally apologized for those actions in 2010.
By a vote of 14-11, the Legal Affairs Committee of the Swiss Parliament has recommended marriage equality for lesbian and gay couples, but in carefully modulated stages. Switzerland is one of the few remaining Western European nations to not have opened the civil institution to those couples. They're currently allowed to enter into less than equal registered partnerships. According to a number of national news sites, committee members wanted to separate allowing same-gender couples to marry from related rights to medically assisted procreation, adoption, and spousal pensions equality. They fear that trying to pass a package with all of those rights at one time, the most controversial being access to fertility services, would fail. One lawmaker predicted basic marriage equality for same-gender couples in Switzerland by January 2021. Queer activists generally voice support for the initiatives, while at the same time lamenting the decision to deal with other rights associated with marriage equality separately and at an as yet undetermined time.
The intentional exclusion of same-gender couples from reforms to surrogacy laws in Israel sparked massive street demonstrations across the country and a nationwide work stoppage on July 22nd that was supported by many of the country's leading companies. The nation's high court hinted its support for the parental rights of same-gender couples this week in two different cases, though no binding decisions were issued. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has come under specific fire for publicly supporting the inclusion of single men to the law reform that opened surrogacy services to single women, only to vote against including single men 2 days later under pressure from conservative Orthodox members of his coalition government. Until then, only married heterosexual couples could access fertility services in Israel. Many commentators believe that opening surrogacy services to single men as well as to single women would have allowed access to those services by same-gender couples.
Meanwhile, a letter circulating in Israel signed by more than 200 rabbis picked at wounds in the queer community that have yet to heal. It supported earlier comments about surrogacy by Jerusalem's chief rabbi Aryeh Stern, who wrote that allowing same-gender couples to become parents would condemn their children to wretched lives. The letter labeled LGBTQ people perverts who want to destroy the concept of family and called the recent street demonstrations for queer rights marches of abomination. The letter went on to claim that the raising of the Second Temple in Jerusalem almost 2,000 years ago was in part due to illicit sexual relations. Among its many critics, lawmaker Stav Shafir of the center-left Zionist Union Party told LGBTQ young people in particular that you are good people, strong, loving, and most importantly, equal. It is forbidden to spend even a minute on these harsh words of leaders who have lost control and are attempting by force to drag us decades backwards. Israeli society has woken up, she said. Stay strong.
And finally, A Connecticut outlet of the increasingly queer-friendly McDonald's fast food chain has posted a welcome of sorts to its just-opened next-door neighbor, Chick-fil-A. The latter eatery made headlines a few years ago when its unapologetically anti-queer CEO, Dan Cathy, said his business was very supportive of the biblical definition of the family unit. A recent story in The New Yorker reported on the many far-right anti-queer causes Cathy still generously supports, and called the restaurant chain's affiliation with conservative religious groups creepy. The sign below the landmark Golden Arches outside the Glastonbury McDonald's usually promotes daily specials, but franchise manager Susan LaFleur put up the simple words, "We welcome everyone," on the side of the marquee facing the next-door chicken franchise. The other side pushes the quarter pounder. LaFleur insisted that the message is not political and that her staff just tries to come up with something cute to say in the limited space on the sign. But photos of the marquee across from the Chick-fil-A have spread like wildfire across social media. New Chick-fil-A franchise owner Jordan Snook was quick to announce that his outlet also welcomes everyone. But McDonald's customer Tina Manis told the local NBC TV affiliate that she drove an hour from her home in Stratford, Connecticut to Glastonbury just to see the shade-throwing signage for herself.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending July 28, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the new and improved thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
I was discriminated against in my country for being a lesbian. They beat me, even some of my friends, when I was 16.
Michael had cried for his mother continuously during the admission process.
Imagine coming from El Salvador to the United States by bus.
Queer persecution amidst the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. Later in the program.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
As if being young and transgender were not difficult enough, YouTube may be making it worse. The Outcasting Overtime crew adds up the algorithms.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Dhruv, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. For this edition, Lucas and I considered YouTube's demonetization of videos with transgender content and its algorithms that contribute to fewer views and the potential pairing of anti-LGBTQ ads on these videos.
YouTube has gone from another entertainment platform to a central part of our everyday online lives. If you want to watch videos, you do it on YouTube. If you want to make videos and potentially have them seen by a large audience, you put them on YouTube. If you want to express your ideas in an open forum, you go to YouTube. YouTube is essentially the default for user-made videos, and therefore it has immense power over what we see and how we see it. According to Google, YouTube's parent company, YouTube tags videos based on different keywords in the title and description of the video. The tagging algorithm determines how frequently videos will appear in searches and what ads will run on them. For example, if your video is about growing apples, it may be tagged as agriculture, which doesn't get flagged by YouTube for any kind of negative content. And logically, it could also pair the videos with ads related to agriculture. But YouTube tags videos with certain trigger words that signal that the video is not suitable for advertisers. This includes references to transgender content, and this has caused a recent uproar among LGBTQ YouTube users. This means that videos containing words like these will likely not generate any money, thus demonetizing videos with transgender content. On top of that, YouTubers have flagged YouTube's search algorithm for being biased against transgender videos and producers. YouTube receives less money from the transgender videos, and so it lists these videos lower in search outputs. These videos, therefore, continue to receive fewer views, making them less marketable. This results in fewer transgender YouTubers being willing to produce videos for no money, which, of course, can lead to less transgender content on YouTube. These creators are effectively being silenced, and their ideas are not being discussed in the same open-minded manner as other content on YouTube. Some may argue that as a business corporation, YouTube's main purpose is to turn a profit for its shareholders. But because of its dominance in the marketplace of ideas, it has a responsibility, which it acknowledges in its policy, to provide a platform to free expression. Adding to the problem, some major anti-LGBTQ organizations buy up ads to run on videos with these tags, specifically to dilute the impact of pro-transgender content. A prime example is the so-called Alliance Defending Freedom, or ADF, which has been designated as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. This anti-LGBTQ targeting contradicts YouTube's anti-hate policy, and yet YouTube allows it to continue. A spokesperson for YouTube claimed, "We have policies against ads on YouTube that incite hatred or promote discrimination, and all ads that run on the platform have to comply with these policies. Even when an ad does not violate our policies, we understand that creators may not want ads from certain advertisers appearing on their videos." So aside from making transgender content harder to find and less financially lucrative, YouTube also violates its own anti-hate policy by allowing advertising from anti-LGBTQ groups. YouTube's actions have driven a wedge between transgender content contributors and the roughly 1.8 billion viewers who use YouTube. This has started to mark transgender contributors as different from the hundreds of millions of now normal contributors. It has also set a precedent allowing transgender media and voices to be sidelined and kept as a separate category. YouTube says it has reworked its algorithm, but creators of transgender content continue to be outraged and sidelined. This goes entirely against the official message of YouTube, that it wants everyone to have a voice, and that contributors should be able to choose the ads on their programs. However, the transgender producers have no choice. Either they run anti-transgender ads, or they don't receive any money from their work, and their video ends up at the bottom of people's searches. We know from conversations we've had here at Outcasting that LGBTQ youth often turn to social media to discover a word that gives them an identity and helps connect them to a community. This is particularly true with transgender youth. After years of confusion about their gender identity, they talk about this as a light bulb going off in their head. "Hey, that's what I am, transgender. It's amazing to finally have a word. There must be other people like me." It's a very powerful and life-changing moment. But if YouTube suppresses this content, it can deprive young people of this critical knowledge. And the situation is exacerbated by the presence on these videos of pre-roll ads from ADF and other anti-LGBTQ groups. Imagine that you're a vulnerable, troubled young teenager who has always felt different but has never known exactly why. You find something on social media, you have that light bulb moment, and everything finally comes into focus, but you're still tentative and maybe a bit fragile. Then you go to YouTube and search for videos that talk about being transgender. Under YouTube's tagging policies, finding that video is harder, and when you do find it, expecting to see something good, something that affirms what little you know about being trans, you're actually bombarded with an anti-LGBTQ ad before you even get to the content you want. Maybe the ad terrifies you, and you turn it off before you even get to the video you wanted to watch. Is it really that hard to figure out that that's exactly what ADF wants? Depriving youth of information that can help them can lead to horrible outcomes. And it's unconscionable for YouTube to suppress this content when it can help so many young people at a vulnerable and fragile point in their lives. YouTube's hypocritical stance is shutting out the voices that need to be heard, and this needs to stop.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producer is Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
You can tweet your concerns about YouTube's policies to @TeamYouTube.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out.
The day we reunited, it was like he felt hurt that I had left him, like he had something that he wanted to tell me, but at his age, he just couldn't express it.
A lesbian mom's asylum nightmare. But first, the grand old rainbow flag turned 40 this year, and a Rainbow Minute looks back at its record-breaking silver anniversary.
A rainbow from sea to sea, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. In 2003, Gilbert Baker, the creator of the original rainbow flag back in 1978, was commissioned to produce a giant rainbow flag for the 25th anniversary of the flag itself. With hot pink no longer a non-standard color for flag production, the flag was restored to its original 8 colors for its silver anniversary unfurling. Those colors included hot pink, red, orange, yellow, green, turquoise, indigo, and violet. Dubbed Rainbow 25 Sea to Sea, the mile and a quarter long by 16 foot wide flag was displayed in Key West, Florida on June 15, 2003. Over 3,000 volunteers held the flag, which ran the length of Duval Street from the Atlantic Ocean on one end to the Gulf of Mexico on the other. At the time, it was deemed the world's longest flag. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Richmond City Councilman Charles Samuels.
Gilbert Baker died in his sleep at his home in New York City on March 31, 2017, at the age of 65.
Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
Mother, mother, keep me safe from harm. Come into my room tonight and hold me in your arms. For I am still your shining child, the one you know by name. Mother, mother.
Toddlers are being torn from their parents and thrown into U.S. immigration baby jails, and the circumstances driving those parents to seek asylum are being ignored. This White House Lucia Chappell has the story of one mother trying to escape violent homophobia at home.
Belka Yesenia Castillo-Cortez arrived at the legal port of entry in Rio Grande City with her 3-year-old son Michael on May 28th. Cortez is a lesbian from El Salvador seeking asylum in the U.S. She explained why in an interview on Democracy Now!
Because I'm in danger in my country. I'm in danger because of the gangs, because of the discrimination, the threats. The same person who raped me in January 2014 is the person who left me pregnant with my child. I was discriminated against in my country for being a lesbian. They beat me, even some of my friends, when I was 16. And the father, if I can call him that, he raped me for the same reason, for being a lesbian, and with the aim of making me pregnant.
Cortez and her son escaped the persecution they faced at home, only to be caught up in the chaos at the U.S. border. They were detained and separated under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy. Cortez was kept at a detention center in Texas, while Michael was flown to a holding facility run by a human services agency in New York City. It took nearly a month and a half for them to be reunited, and their nightmare was still not over.
Suddenly they called me, and oh, it was so beautiful because it had been 41 days without my son, and I felt like I couldn't any longer. The reunion with my son was something, well, it was emotional, but also sad because he didn't react the way his mother, the way I imagined he would have reacted. He just turned and looked at me. He didn't cry. He just looked into my eyes. He looked at me and never broke his gaze.
As the extended Democracy Now! Interview continued, Michael started biting a Nerf ball. And by the time it was over, he had chewed the ball completely into pieces. Michael's discharge papers from the holding facility described him as laid back, quiet, and kindly, but also noted his difficulty adapting to the program, as Michael had cried for his mother continuously during the admission process. Cortez talked about the traumatic impact of the separation and detention on her son.
His behavior is really aggressive. He doesn't listen to me at all. Yes, I'm having this problem because since we arrived, he's been acting this way, and he wasn't like this before. I went with him in buses the whole way, and imagine coming from El Salvador to the United States by bus. I brought him from there to here, and everything was fine, because in truth, he wasn't like this before. Because to travel 6 hours, 8 hours on a bus with a child, as he's acting now, I imagine I would have had to return to my country. But no, he held out till the 28th of May, and now he's acting very differently. He doesn't listen. He's violent, more than anything else with me. Ever since he was released to me, he doesn't listen to me anymore. Sometimes he hits me. The day we reunited, the reunion, it was like he felt hurt that I had left him. Something like that. I felt like he had something that he wanted to tell me, but at his age, he just couldn't express it because he just stayed looking at me with a face, with a gaze that told me everything. It was beautiful to reunite with him, but to be confronted with this, no. A week has passed, exactly. At the beginning, it was the same. He didn't seem to love me very much, but now, thank God, it's changing a bit. Now he knows our family. Now he's remembered because, well, maybe it's more like he never forgot. It was just the feelings that he had because he felt abandoned.
Belka Yesenia Castillo-Cortez and her son Michael are out of detention and awaiting a decision on their asylum request. Cortez is being tracked by the government with an ankle monitor while her case is pending, and Michael is receiving psychological services provided by immigrant rights organizations. The lesbian mother holds on to the hope of finding liberation in the U.S.
I want a future. I want to begin a future with a person I love to marry. I also want that. I want to be happy with my child and my family. I also want protection and the support I don't have in my country. This is why I came, for a happy future. Because up until now, it hasn't. I've never had any freedom, not even with the girlfriends I've had. Absolutely nothing. It's as if we're not there. We've always been hidden. It hasn't been freedom or happiness. Not at all.
For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle.
Our thanks again to Democracy Now! And reporter Laura Gottesdiener. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Michelle Yater, produced with Ryan DeShazer, from Outcasters Groove and Lucas, produced by Mark Soffice, Charles Samuels, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Lucia Chappelle, with thanks to Democracy Now! David Brown and Chris Williamson performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the redesigned thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WNJR, Washington, Pennsylvania, to TLC, Yamba, New South Wales, WNRB, Wausau, Wisconsin, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.